Reporting on the news from the world's conflict zones has a powerful way of showing you the value of life and the meaning of home. In just a minute, we're delighted to talk to New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof to hear what he's learned from a career as a top-notch journalist. And an Australian cook and podcaster living in France shares tips for enjoying the fabulous food scene in Paris affordably, the way he and his neighbors do. That's a little later in the hour on today's Travel with Rick Steves. For the past 40 years, Nicholas Kristof has been writing for the New York Times as a foreign correspondent, as a bureau chief in Hong Kong, Beijing, and Tokyo, and as a columnist. In his new book, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, he provides a candid look at his work, the lessons he's learned, and why good journalism remains so important to our democracy. Nick joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves from his home in Oregon's Willamette Valley to let us stow away with him on the road as a foreign correspondent. Nick, it's so good to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Boy, oh boy, I gotta say, I'm a little tired right now because I couldn't put your book down last night. It is, what a story you have to tell. And you know, this is a travel show, and Chasing Hope is really a collection of great travel moments from the memories of a foreign correspondent. A lot of skills in extreme travel that you employ to do your work.
Yeah, I mean, we've both figured out how to travel for a career, in a sense, and see the world. And it's been an amazing journey, I think, for both of us.
You know, for instance, I love that you wrote about the best seat on the train in Sudan is on the roof. You've had some memorable best seats, I think.
I mean, it truly is. I mean, you know, inside there are rats and cockroaches, and on the roof, you're out in the open, and I mean, the only thing you worry about is you see all these carcasses of other trains that derailed, and you kind of wonder about the people who'd been on top of those trains.
Yeah. You know, the great thing I took away from Chasing Hope is your optimism, your ability to see the bright side. I mean, a lot of people would say you're just reporting on the worst of humanity, but at the same time, you see something else.
Yeah, Rick, I mean, I think that's a mistake that we in journalism make, that we... Look, I mean, bad news is news, and we have to cover the terrible news. But I think we don't often enough provide the context, the trajectory of improvement that underlays that. When I first began traveling the world in the early 1980s, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, there was so much blindness everywhere that was really left a deep impression on me, from river blindness, from trachoma, from cataracts, et cetera. And now there is so much less blindness, you know, more tumbled extraordinarily because of the work of Jimmy Carter and 1,000 other people.
Right.
Likewise, you know, I think maybe the worst thing that could happen to somebody is to lose a child. And when I was born, that 1/5 of babies died before the age of 5. Mm. When I graduated from college, 11% did. And now we're down to, this year, we'll set a new record for an all-time low in the share of children dying by the age of 5, a little more than 3%. You know, there is a lot going on that is good that we don't always acknowledge.
Well, you wrote something like, when you're doing your reporting, covering events, that's 75% of it is bad, and that's what gets covered over trends. In trends, 75% of it is good.
Exactly. We cover events, which are mostly bad, and we don't much cover trends, which are mostly good. And, you know, obviously, there are exceptions. And I think people sometimes feel that, oh, if you pay too much attention to the good news, somehow you're, you know, being complacent about the risks.
Yeah.
And I don't see that at all. I think it rather it fortifies us to take on those challenges, which are very real.
You and I are both interested in world hunger in a world with such abundance and affluence. How can this be? And it can be very depressing when you look at how extreme poverty, people trying to live on less than on about $2 a day, has ticked up in the last decade. But if you look at it in a broader scope, in our lifetime, it's cut by about half, hasn't it?
Yeah. And extreme poverty rose during the pandemic a little bit. I mean, the data is still fragile post-pandemic, but it appears to have come back down. And like when I graduated from college, 41% of the world's people lived in extreme poverty. Mm-hmm. Now we're at about 8%.
So, but that,
there's been incredible improvement.
The challenge for any journalist who's wanting people to read his stuff is not to get sucked into what will be my best writer's equivalent of clickbait, but what will really tell the story that needs to be told.
Yeah. I mean, so what I tell people is that side by side with the worst of humanity, you encounter the very best.
Yeah.
And so I've met a lot of warlords. I've seen covered genocide and war.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, that has left a deep impression on me. I've seen a lot of massacres. But when you are in the field in that way, you also see these just heroic figures who just, you're just in total awe of them.
You know, there's a photograph in your book of a little boy who was clearly malnourished in Yemen, I think. And you and him do a fist bump.
A fist bump, yeah. That was in Yemen.
So, Nick, when you look at his face, so full of life and joy in what seems like such a miserable world for him, what do you think?
One of the lessons, Rick, from travel, and I'm sure you felt that, is that you go to far off places and you just understand that fundamentally we're all so much alike. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's this little boy in Yemen at the middle of a civil war from a culture that could not be more different than our own. And he's so much like my kids. And I see him and I see my two sons in him. And yet it also breaks your heart because he's not getting the nutrition that my sons are getting. He's not getting those opportunities. And it just reminds one that, you know, the adage that talent is universal, but opportunity is not.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Nicholas Kristof, and he's just released a memoir about his life as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times, and his book is called Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. Nick gives vivid accounts of lessons learned from traveling into major conflict zones and into nearly every corner of this planet. His opinion column appears twice a week in the New York Times. Nick, we're talking about like extreme travel skills that you've picked up as a foreign correspondent, getting the best seat, being an optimist, meeting people. In your work, you meet people in dangerous situations, and I was fascinated by your skill at taking what seems to be something that could really be deadly and defusing it by flattering your captors. Talk to me a little bit about that.
As a foreign correspondent covering wars, or as a columnist covering wars, you regularly meet people with guns who just might kill you. And so it does become, you know, a crucial skill to defuse that. And what you do, you walk up to them, you shake their hands, you look them in the eye, you maybe ask a little about their family or themselves, and you indicate your interest in interviewing them. And warlords tend to think that they have something important for the world to hear, and so they tend to be willing to talk to a reporter. And, you know, it's pretty clear that if they shoot me, their views are not going to get published. So they then become dependent on me surviving and getting out to write
something.
I think
that's brilliant. You wrote they like to pontificate, so give them a chance.
Yeah, and, you know, you are careful, and if they decide to rob you, you should have a decoy wallet in you know, that you can hand over that has some respectable amount of money, but not everything. You know, if a gunman asks for your wallet, it's only polite to offer him a wallet, but you don't want to give him your real one.
With these sort of skills you have, you've got to get into the action and talk to the people. I mean, you told a story in your book about in Afghanistan, how these guys make a fake camp. And then they make money telling Americans about the camp. Round that story out, because it's just amazing what you learn just by sleuthing.
Yeah, this was during the Afghan war. And it was one of the moments when I realized that maybe this is going to be an uphill battle for us, that we have all of the weaponry, but we don't necessarily have the understanding and intelligence to make it work. And so these Afghans were telling me how they would set up a kind of a fake Taliban camp on a hilltop with a fire and some tents around it. And then they would sell to the U.S. the information about where the supposed Taliban camp was. And then the U.S. would drop, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of bombs on this set of empty tents. And then a day or two later, these entrepreneurs would go and pick up the metal and sell it for recycling. And so they made money two times around on that process. And meanwhile, the U.S. was spending a lot of money bombing dirt.
My goodness. You must just feel like you hit the jackpot when you get a story like that. And you can translate it into things that Americans need to know. I mean, you know that we pay about $1 million a year to keep a soldier in Afghanistan. And you learned about how much of that $1 million gets leaked through corruption and actually funds the Taliban, right?
Yeah, I was talking to some Afghan business people who were working for the U.S. military and shipping equipment for the U.S. military. And they were explaining how they had to pay very large sums to the Taliban to get the U.S. supplies through the Taliban checkpoints. And the upshot was that the large amounts of what the U.S. government was paying for transport were actually going to the Taliban to fund a large number of Taliban soldiers. So we were fighting the Taliban, who were being paid with our military budget in part. And again, it was just a reminder of how complicated it is and the burden we have in trying to carry out policies in distant countries and cultures.
New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof is our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. His latest book is a memoir, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life. Do you ever think about the value of soft power compared to hard power and what that $1 million could do? I know you're into women's issues and water and poverty in the developing world. You know, $1 million could drill 100 wells for 100 thirsty communities. And I always think that would be more effective in making us safe than bombing a fake camp on some hillside in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and I don't know that there's good data on the wells, but there is good data on education, and especially girls' education, and the impact that has on conflict. Over time, educating girls has a real impact on the propensity of a country to engage in violence, partly because as women become more empowered, they have more voices in the community, they are more of a restraining influence, and partly because of the impact on fertility, that you educate a boy and he will have fewer children, but it's a somewhat small effect. You educate a girl and it has a dramatic effect on the number of children she will have. And when you have fewer children, you have less of an age population that is skewed young. Mm-hmm. And young populations tend to be more militaristic, more likely to have rebellions. And so, you know, this isn't an immediate effect. It takes time to educate people to see this through. But if we had done this after the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, I think that Afghanistan would be a safer, more friendly country, and Afghans themselves would be way better off.
There's more with reporter and columnist Nicholas Kristof in just a minute as we take a closer look at the role that honest journalism plays in advancing democratic societies, despite the economic threats many newspapers and broadcasters are facing. Later in the hour, we'll get you ready to enjoy the food scene in Paris. An Aussie expat recommends how you can enjoy the most delicious city in the world like the locals do. It's Travel with Rick Steves.